Father Alexei spent time in the city of Ostrov, south of Pskov. In his memories, he recalls the tears of the people during the service for the one feast of the protection of the Mother of God. He refers to October 14th, New Style. And so many years of atheism, he writes, after many years of atheism, they sang in local traditional chant, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and more honorable than the cherubim." Father Alexei wonders why these people were weeping during the service. Was it out of joy or out of sorrow? He writes, "I can only remember one thing, sharing the sorrow of my own new spiritual children. I was weeping together with them." Father George, in the meantime, Bennigsen, describes his service within the mission in the following way. "At the beginning of my stay in Pskov, I was in the cathedral for a short time, and then I was given that last open church, which was the 14th century church of St. Demetrius, a cemetery church with a large group of people. And since it was a cemetery church, I had an unbelievable number of funerals every week. Plus, I was able to open a school, which was more important. By the end of our stay there, I had about 200 kids in the school. Now, Germans are peculiar people. If you were able to prove to them that the school taught only religion, they did not mind. As a matter of fact, some German soldiers were willing to look at those children as an employed element. They even gave them food cards and did not mobilize them for any kind of other work. Thus, we were able to save a rather sizable percentage of young people. We taught them some Russian and some Russian history, but basically it was 5 days, 6 days a week of religion, which was very useful because the kids did not know anything, and they were absorbing unbelievably, like sponges, everything that was told to them about religion. Things were printed. Father Nicholas Vaglis was printing some things in Riga, some other places were helping us. So we used whatever was available. The Metropolitan stayed in Riga, but he would come once in a while and visit Pskov. He continues, "I ended my stay at St. Demetrius Church having just organized a school, but also had an orphanage for about 40 kids, because these were times when kids were lost quite easily. Their parents were killed, the front separated families, and so on. So I had about 40 kids who I was able to organize into an orphanage, not without help from some good German Christians at that time. But then I moved from that church together with my orphanage to the ancient monastery. This is the monastery of Miroj in Pskov. So I had my orphanage there, and then I was appointed the sacristan of the cathedral. My last months were spent between the cathedral and the place where I had my orphanage. I did mostly pastoral work before returning back to Latvia in the early spring of 1944. Meanwhile, Father Nicholas Vaglis assisted in whatever way possible to support the work of the Pskov mission. Here's an interesting explanation of how more clergy were added to assist in the mission. He says, 15 priests was as a drop in the ocean, as the Russians say, nothing for such a large territory. And he was referring to the initial group that went. The Exarch, or Metropolitan, told me to get in touch with those missionaries to find out among the Russian people who would like to be a priest. But they did not need to ask about marital status or education. If someone wanted to be a priest, they were just sent to Riga. I registered them. I had the official order not to ask about marital status. The Exarch took this on his own personal responsibility. In Russia, some were married and some were not. Some were married and then sent to Siberia, or the wife married someone else who later could be a priest, but she had been previously married. The Exarch knew this condition and decided to ordain even those who did not have a clear marital status. He took this on his own personal responsibility. And so some 60 men came from there to be ordained. Everyone was ordained, nobody was rejected. This is a truly unusual time. And in History of the Russian Church, the professor Pospilevsky explained that by the end of the mission, 1944, the number of churches in the Pskov, Leningrad, and Novgorod provinces had risen to 200, served by 175 priests. So that is basically in 2.5 years, going from from one, maybe one open church with one priest or two priests to this amazing number of renovated churches. Another, Father Nicholas continues. They came from Russia, these candidates, Pskov, Novgorod, and that area. They didn't come all at once, but little by little, two or three at a time. And the Germans gave them the possibility to come and the use of the railroad. My duty was to get them uniforms. Vestments were easier because in those churches there were many complete sets, and the church administration was happy to give these for the mission. Another interesting reminiscence illustrates Father Nicholas's resourcefulness. An interesting thing was that the crosses and the silver. During the communist occupation, one man took a bag of silver Latvian money. It was unusable during the communist occupation, but everyone was supposed to give it back to the bank for the communists. That man didn't do it, and he was afraid to keep it in his house. So he brought it to the church and just donated it for the church. Do with it what you want, but I don't need it. But I didn't want to give it back to them, so I dug a hole in the ground and put it there. And this money was used for crosses. A jeweler made crosses. That's providence, you know, everything the church provided. You couldn't get wine in stores, but the Germans gave in order to give wine to the church. And now, of course, here in this and other Western countries, Germans are seen as very bad. Of course, they had their own politics. Maybe they helped the church because it was according to their politics. Communists were against the church, but the Germans helped by doing everything for the church. One of the significant events in the life of the Pskov mission occurred later that year. Among the, I'm quoting here, I think this is from Father Nicholas. Among the German army were cultural workers who took an interest in icons and buildings. Many of them were of Russian origin, old immigrants who came to Germany after the First World War. When the Germans were close to Leningrad or Petrograd, they already occupied Novgorod. They were near the city of Tikhvin. The Russian captives, or cultural workers, had the chance to talk with the German administration, and they told them about the Tikhvin Monastery. It was in a no-man's land between the German and Soviet armies. The captives told them that there was a wonder-working icon in Tikhvin. And now explains that over gunfire in this no-man's land, the icon was taken from the monastery and brought to the city of Novgorod first, and then to Pskov. Here, Father George continues the story. We received from the Germans the miraculous icon of Our Lady of Tikhvin. The German authorities wanted to make a little propaganda act for the local religious population, so the icon was given to us in very solemn conditions. It was brought in a procession from the commandant's headquarters in Pskov to the cathedral with German officers and clergy and choirs and banners and everything else. Before it was brought to the cathedral, it was delivered to us in that mission house, Father Nicholas Kolobersky's house. We kept it on a large table, standing upright. It was New Year's night, 1942, and we had our New Year's Molebin in front of that icon. The next day was announced to the people that in the churches that if they wanted would like to come and venerate the icon, they were welcome to come to the mission headquarters and do so. People started coming in lines and lines. Father George related stories of meeting up with General Vlasov's army, which was made up of Russian soldiers who had joined a resistance movement in the German-occupied territories to liberate Russia of the Soviet yoke. And importantly, Father Alexei left a remarkable gift in writing of his memories of the 2.5 years of the mission. I'm going to read for you part of that. There are several stories. I just picked one. And if we have time, I'll read another one. But I chose this one because it gives a sense of Father Alexei's character in that he was an educator, it seemed to me, from what I can gather from his writing. I remember the young Soviet teachers with whom I had held the most intimate conversations. One of them, who had been taught at the Herzen Pedagogical Institute in Leningrad all the time assured me, although I do not believe in God, I do not renounce him. Prove it to me so that I am convinced and I will believe. This same teacher reproached me because I didn't visit him on Christmas, saying, we waited for you so long and we hung up an icon. But probably hanging the icon was his wife's idea, as she was a believer. Another teacher who had a refined love of poetry and literature recounted his reading of forbidden poets in illegal gatherings of literary groups. Already in America, I had met such an aesthete who, because of his fascination with illegal poets, had had to sit through a very long term in the camps in Siberia. I found the best relationships with these Communist Party aspirants. They assisted me in great deal in providing help to the inhabitants of the town who were in need when I organized something no more less than the Russian Red Cross. The Germans put up with this organization until my departure to Pskov. We posted on all the streetcars, we posted on all the streets our call for a collection of food goods for the military prisoners, and we took on ourselves the care for one camp for military prisoners. Of course, we didn't have the ability to feed the roughly 200 people, but we tried at least to add a little nourishment, giving them a human dinner twice a week. They stopped dying after 2 or 3 weeks. In this work, the wives of Soviet officers helped me very much. One had to see the self-abnegation, their persistence, and the genuine Christian mercifulness of these women. My best friends were the children. There were a great multitude of them, dressed in rags, tattered, and hungry. They nevertheless remained beautiful Russian children. I soon started to conduct formal lessons with them in the law of God, that is, religious education. How they made me rejoice with their progress. They learned the prayers as if they were competing to see who could do it the fastest. Their attention toward everything of the church was amazing. In the church, they would take the very first places and patiently stand through our long services that were not fit for children. I remember the youth too, 17 or 19 years of age. Once on the street, two girls stopped me. We have something for you to do, Batushka. Pointing to the other, one of them said, for a long time, she did not believe in God. I proved to her that God exists. She now no longer doubts. Now we have to baptize her. As well as I could, I prepared her, so you don't have to work with her too much. With interest, I looked on these young Christians. That was the first time I'd heard from the mouth of a 16-year-old girl, the words, I proved to her that God exists. I baptized Svetlana. At the baptism, I offered to her to let her keep her old name. To this, she firmly answered me, no, I want to have everything new now. Everything new, he continues. These two girls formed the beginning of a religious education study group in which I led conversation, so-called evangelization. That term goes back to the one Father George mentioned, that the Germans, they had a concept of confirmation classes, and if you could prove that you were doing something similar, they wouldn't bother you. Twice a week, these evangelization classes. The numbers of the members of this little study group soon reached 40. Into it entered people of various ages. Among them were doctors, teachers, dressmakers, and simple housewives. If I had made even one announcement about our studies, then the number of members would have increased much greater, but I was not able to do this. I had too much other work, and I was alone. The region entrusted to me stretched over a 50 to 70 kilometer radius. Once I was called into the military commander on account of the activity of this little group. He said, according to our information, you are gathering the peasant youth at your place. For what purpose? I respond, it is not a peasant youth meeting that is gathering at my place, but Christian youth. I am gathering them there for confirmation. To these German Lutherans, this answer was considered satisfactory. They dismissed me in peace to continue the confirmation of the Russian youth. Despite the initial military successes of the Germans, as well as the brief but tangible respite from famine due to the policies of the Germans, not to completely rob the local population of all the sources of their livelihood. And finally, the great successes of the relaxed policy in letting the Pskov mission flourish and even providing some goods and materials needed for the restoration of churches and the transportation of the missionaries. The German occupation came to an end in 1944. And likewise, the life of the young bishop who made it all possible under the most difficult of historical circumstances. Father Nicholas and Father George, as well as a priest's wife from Poland, Matuszka Ludmila, who's a friend of my wife's family, passed away several years back, all relate a story told to them by Metropolitan Sergei. And Matuszka Ludmila lived in Lithuania. But they were tied together at this time because the Exarch's jurisdiction was over not just Latvia, but Latvia and Lithuania. And this story they shared from the Metropolitan's own mouth about a prophecy he had heard while in prison in the Soviet Union. So Father George said, once, this is quoting Metropolitan Sergei, once when I was sitting in the jail was crowded. I was sitting on the upper platform where people were sleeping. An old man sat next to me, and somehow he recognized the priest in me, although I was not in Riasa. He said, Father, are you a priest? I said, yes, I'm a priest. It was pretty dark there. I don't immediately remember his face, but he said to me, you know, I can see the future. He told me that either in 1943 or at the age of 43, I would die of a bullet. And Matuszka Ludmila had essentially the same reminiscence, slightly different date, but she said, priests and bishops were kept separated from others in the prison. Each day, one person would be chosen to be killed. One day, Sergius, when he was an Archimandrite, said to a man, perhaps I'll be taken today. The man replied that he would not be taken, but in 1946, he would be killed by gunshots. So whatever prophecy heard there was told to a selected, not every, you know, these were people who were close to the Metropolitan. Father George, Father Nicholas, Matuszka Ludmila and her husband. And so, but it's the same kind of central prophecy. On April 29th, 1944, the Metropolitan was traveling from Kaunas in Lithuania to Riga with his driver, a deacon and his wife, and a Russian soloist, and were brutally gunned down.